You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Hello, comrades. This is your host of the Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach. I apologize about some of the technical difficulties we were having, but we're back, and they can't stop the signal. So we are here today for another great edition of the show to discuss some questions that have been brought up, and I absolutely love input from all my listeners and all my comrades on different topics. So I thought I could take today to be able to answer one that I've gotten a lot about how we can win, how we can push forward, and understanding both our history, the past of the white nationalist movement in America, trends that have worked, tactics that have worked, and things for the modern day. I'm going to be talking a lot today about Governor George Wallace in 1968, 1972, and his race, also lessons we can learn from Donald Trump, of course, and what's going on in Europe. And we also must understand, though, the changes when it comes to our long-term plans. And that's something, of course, here at Radio Arian, Harold Covington's podcast, is here every single week. Absolutely love his podcast and his novels. If you haven't read them, from the Northwest Front, I very much would suggest going ahead and listening or reading those. But understanding the changes in demographics, of course. When Governor Wallace was running in 1968, America was almost a 90% white country. And of course, things have drastically changed due to the 1965 Immigration Act. But here today, we need to be able to have a blueprint to victory. It's not enough just to have our ideas. Our ideas are great, our ideas are right, but we need to be able to have a strategy to be able to push forward and to be able to win. And it's so important because the current political climate is so turned against us. It's not just the changing demographics. If you actually look, something I thought was very interesting, reading a quote from Bill Clinton just yesterday, characterizing Trump voters as being your standard redneck. And of course, it's very funny to be able to see Bill Clinton when he was running for governor, when he was running for president in the 1990s. He was all about the folksy. They had semi-official Clinton-Gore buttons back in the day that had Confederate flags on them. He really pumped himself up as being a man of the soil, pumped himself up as being a regular, everyday, blue-collar-style Democrat. And of course, we see what really happens, that that's a facade, because the Clintons, as a dynasty, have been involved now for over a generation in the political elite. The Hillary Clinton email leaks tell us that Hillary Clinton is more in bed with international Jewry, with the lobbyists, and with the bankers, and of course with Zionist interests, with the policies she advocated as a senator, the policies she advocated as Secretary of State, and those that she's putting forward as the potential new president of the United States. She is 100% against our people. Normal, everyday, white, working families. And Bill Clinton, by calling us standard rednecks, it continues this trend that we see from the Democrats. Of course, Hillary Clinton said not too long ago she was joking in a very mean way about coal people that support Trump in places like East Kentucky and West Virginia, areas where coal mining jobs, as dangerous as they were, were there to be able to provide a sustainable series of jobs for the communities. They were able to take areas and give them opportunities so families could be raised, children could be able to be taken care of. And now those jobs aren't here anymore, not only because a lot of the coal reserves have been used, but also because people like President Obama and supported by Secretary Clinton wanting to go ahead and to destroy those jobs. And the thing about white working class communities, as we all know, they're not looking to phase out coal and then have a massive investment, the New Deal style, getting lots of jobs, lots of training, lots of investment in these areas to replace them. No, they're just leaving them to die. And that goes along, of course, with the Republican policies. And of course, Barack Obama talked about our people. You know, he's always talking about white working class people who are clinging to their Bibles and their guns and their traditions and mocking us. And this is, we need to understand that the system hates us. It hates our way of life. It hates our societies. And they joke about it. They have no problem joking about it, because the Democratic Party has become the party of non-whites. It has become the party the rootless cosmopolitans, the white Gentile collaborators that live in gated communities, of course, the Jewish oligarchs at the top, and then the masses of black folks, brown folks, every folk other than white folks, to be able to wage this war against us, both demographically displacing us and culturally displacing us, and of course making us pay for it the entire time. The Republicans, on the flip side, of course, so you see with National Review, they published a series of articles over the past 6 months, specifically condemning white working class communities. Their entire focus, actually, is demonizing white working class communities, saying that the problems that we face, basically, we deserve them, and we need to just die because we're economically not turning out what they want. And of course, that shows, as Commander George Lincoln Rockwell says, a conservative wants to save his money, a national socialist wants to save his race. And these conservatives put profit ahead of everything. They are just as rootless and cosmopolitan as the Democratic elites and the people who hate us. So both sides of the coin of mainstream politics hate us, and we see what's happening with Donald Trump. The attack on him with Paul Ryan after Paul Ryan's primary. Of course, Donald Trump actually endorsed him, a move that I didn't agree with, but he was trying to push for Republican unity. And here we are less than a month away from the election, and Paul Ryan has betrayed Trump. He's called all the high-ranking Republican politicians to betray Trump and to focus just on House races, just on Senate races, when Donald Trump can win this election in a way that other Republican candidates cannot. Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, all these types of candidates have no potential to be able to win a race. If we were to go back in time and Trump hadn't have run, the Republicans would be much, much closer to defeat when it comes to the presidential election than with Donald Trump, because Donald Trump has the potential to be able to turn out white working class voters that are, one, disenfranchised with the system and perhaps don't vote. Huge swaths of white working class folks have given up voting because they understand on an instinctual level, perhaps they don't understand the Jewish question or racial issues as we do, but they understand that these politicians hate them, use them, and are actively waging war on both sides of the aisle against them. So, you know, they've kind of grown tired of the system. They realize that nothing's going to change. There was really no difference between Reagan or Clinton or Bush or Barack Obama. The same policies of sending our sons off to die in foreign wars hasn't changed. Destroying our way of life hasn't changed. Forcing mass immigration hasn't changed. The traditional values that we believe in, such as marriage or the right to life for the unborn, all of that, the policies are continued on the same track. They basically just change conductors at the station every 4 or 8 years with the political establishment, and nothing's going to change. So, of course, they've now betrayed Donald Trump, which, you know, we could all expect that the Jews, it's looking like this supposed Pussygate leak, I hate to call it that, but I don't know what else to call it, with this tape of some locker room banter that Donald Trump was saying with a host of a show he was being interviewed on 11 years ago. It looks like it actually came from the Republican side of the aisle, people affiliated with the Republican Party. So they are trying to not just not help Trump, but actively sabotage him. And that's because, of course, he is speaking to the white working class. They do not want to empower us. This isn't even about the presidential election as much as I believe it is wanting to stamp out any sense of identity or power of the white working class. Because we still in this country have the numbers that we can be extremely politically powerful. We can have a path to victory to achieve our goals. But it's only once we realize internally and amongst our community that we have this power. Right now, we're sitting there getting beaten. We've got a sword to our left that we could pick up and fight back against those that are destroying our people and way of life, to be able to regain control over our communities, to be able to say, we don't want these wars. We don't want to be dominated by Wall Street. We want to put our communities first. We want sovereignty. We want safety. If we just realize we can stand up and push back, then we could be able to accomplish a lot of those goals just based, as bad as demographics are right now in the United States, and of course they're getting worse for European Americans, we still have a tremendous amount of power. So I believe the Republicans, it's not even about Donald Trump. It really is that Donald Trump has been able to galvanize huge numbers of white working class voters, former Democrats, people that don't vote, and that they don't want that to happen. Because if we can elect Trump, we will be emboldened. There's going to then be a growing idea that we can seize power. We start to understand our own strength to a certain degree. And that's something that the system does not want us to have. So looking forward, the Jews, of course, that as Dr. Joseph Goebbels said, you can either be a Jewish lackey or you can be an opponent to Judaism. Those are the only two choices. And the Republican establishment is 110% lackeys of the Jews. The Democrats, 100% lackeys of the Jews. And our people are the ones who are caught between a rock and a hard place. And we need to be able to encourage them. So moving forward, kind of to the main purpose of the show today, is the idea on how we can regain our power and how we can move forward. And Donald Trump, of course, is the topic of a huge amount of discussion, but I want to go back in time. I want to go back in time to 1968. Governor George Wallace of Alabama, of course, really was kind of the proto-Trump in many regards. And you can see that, of course, the left-wing media has endlessly talked about this, about his populist rhetoric, about his political incorrectness, but also his desire to be able to end wars. Governor Wallace historically said that if Vietnam couldn't be won in 90 days, he was going to bring the American soldiers home because it wasn't worth sending tens of thousands of Americans to be killed and hundreds of thousands to be psychologically damaged or butchered on the field of battle in a war that we weren't able to win, that we shouldn't have been there anywhere. You know, as our cities were burning up in civil rights riots, the Black Lives Matter of the day, he wanted to bring our soldiers home, and that broke him from the establishment of the Democratic Party that was far more nationalist in a certain degree back in the 60s, but that was beginning to change, and before the Democrats under President Nixon fully implemented the Southern strategy, which was the dog whistling towards white working class interests. And of course, now the Republicans are partying like we're already a minority. So they've abandoned the Southern strategy, and Trump is kind of using to a certain degree. But I want to look at where Governor Wallace was able to be extremely successful. And I want to be able to just start with a quote from him when he became governor of the great state of Alabama. He said, "Today I have stood where Jefferson Davis stood and took an oath to my people. It is very appropriate then, from this cradle of the Confederacy, this very heart of the great Anglo-Saxon Southland, that today we sound the drum for freedom. In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever." To which he received huge applause from the crowd. And that was to be understood, you know, of course, in the racial context of not wanting this multicultural experiment that's been forced on Europe and the entire American populace, that there was a rejection of this forced integration that was happening. But it was also a rejection of the political status quo, because you had back then, just as today, you had the sellout so-called conservatives that were saying that the South maintaining these institutions were bad for business, the Chamber of Commerce Republicans we would have today. And of course, you had the social justice warriors of the day, backed with huge amounts of Jewish money, coming into the South, forcing desegregation, using court cases, using riots, using anything they could to be able to force their agenda of this multicultural experiment that was bound for failure from the beginning, as we're seeing today in Europe and here in the United States. Governor Wallace literally declared that he drew a line the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And that emboldened the people not only of Alabama, but the people of the South, and not just in the South. He was able to speak to a huge amount of white working class folks in the North, in the Midwest. In 1968, he was actually polling in many areas up to 40-50% of white working class voters in places like Philadelphia, in white working class areas of Chicago, of white working class areas all throughout the United States. And it was only then when Nixon basically had to move to the right, you know, an increasing amount, to be able to follow that example. And then, of course, Nixon ran as the law and order candidate, something that was started by George Wallace. He began talking against forced federal integration policies. He began taking a much harder line on black rioters. And that was an amazing thing. And it was done because George Wallace was able to influence the American public and to be able to really get that message out there. But where this is important to us is understanding the message of guys like Governor Wallace. It was based on populism, you know, economic populism. It's not exactly National Socialism, but it is being against the Wall Street executives, being against the billionaires, speaking on one hand like a Bernie Sanders and the other side like a Donald Trump. The idea of populism, of putting common people first, investing in education, investing in infrastructure, investing in job growth. These are messages that resounded and really hit the hearts of white working class families, not just in the South, but throughout the United States. And that was very, very successful, something that we should be looking at politically today to think that we're not based just in a region. Of course, you know, I live in the Midwest now. I'm a Southerner by birth. I love the South. I love my adopted home here in Indiana. And this message is very, very popular to this day. And understand being against the federal government encroachment. You know, while we had desegregation, you know, 50 years ago, two generations ago, now we've got forced refugee resettlement in places like Idaho and Montana and here in Indiana. And the people are against this. Again, they might not 100% agree with us. Of course, Governor Wallace took a very strong stand on maintaining segregation within the South, but he was able to win huge amounts of support from white voters in areas that had never even had segregation, but didn't want these forced policies. And of course, we can see Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, very famously in the suburbs of Chicago, was able to mobilize thousands of white working class men and women to march against Martin Luther King, because Martin Luther King had come to the suburbs to where there was no legal segregation. Of course, this is the incremental approach of the Jews, of the left. They say, first of all, we just want equality. We want to be able to have everyone uses the same bathrooms, everyone goes to the same schools, but we're not going to go after communities. And then as soon as they get that, as soon as the Civil Rights Act is put into effect, then they start marching against de facto segregation, as they called it, which is known as community choice, which is known as school choice, where people used to be able to have housing communities where you would choose to have, it could be just Germans, it could be just Poles, to be able to, you know, really control who came and lived in your community. The community had that choice. And it wasn't a state law. It wasn't a federal law. It was just community choice. And that wasn't allowed. That's where Martin Luther King and the forces of black anarchy, led, of course, by the Jewish Pied Piper, started marching in to white working class communities in places like Illinois that, again, had never had Jim Crow, had never had segregation. It wasn't about the South. It was in one part because we were leading the way in opposing the forced multicultural experiment, but that wasn't enough for the system. Anywhere where whites were able to have our own space, wherever we were able to organize for ourselves and our own interests, that is what they determined then was the enemy. It's just what we see today. These tactics that they're using have not changed. The entire purpose of multiculturalism is to take any place where whites organize and live and just want to be left alone and forcibly integrating them with people that have a different ethnicity, have a different culture, different religion, different values, with the purpose of blockbusting, essentially, our communities one street at a time, and then making sure that we never have a single place to call our own. That is the purpose of multiculturalism, and they were doing this back in the 1960s. They said that they had, you know, won their initial victory, but it wasn't going to be complete until everywhere was diverse. And that is exactly the policy of George Soros. That is exactly the policy of the global elites, of the Kalergi plan with the European Union, of making sure that there is no white space left. There is no place to call our own. That is what their plan was. So Governor Wallace, when he stood up to oppose forced integration of communities, forced busing of white students into black neighborhoods, and forcing black students into white schools, he opposed all that, and he was able to win tremendous support from the everyday white working class man and woman who didn't want this. You know, he spoke out against globalist imperialist wars, as we mentioned. He talked against Wall Street. He talked against federal overreach, destroying community choice, and that was really able to galvanize a huge number of everyday white people. And how does this affect us today? I think we can learn a lot from Governor Wallace in seeing that we're not limited just to one specific region, but we need to be able to have a message tailored that every white man and woman that's affected by multiculturalism, as we've seen, we talked about on the show previously, the violence is gearing up, as we saw with the Brian Ogle case, a young man who was beaten almost to death for supporting Blue Lives Matter and supporting the police. The violence is coming to our streets. It doesn't matter if you're a young girl like we saw with the refugees in Idaho who raped a mentally challenged 6-year-old girl and filmed it and laughed about it This is affecting all of us. The policies of Barack Obama with the Housing and Urban Development program from the United States of resettling refugees, resettling immigrants, going up against communities that are majority white and trying to forcibly diversify them. These policies are affecting all whites around the country. So identifying that this affects all of us, I think, is a very, very important message for us to be able to go forward to every white person and say, you can't opt out of this system. They're waging a war against all of you. And as multiculturalism continues, the death count that it's racking up, the broken families, the lost lives, and the tragic rapes and sexual assaults of our women, this is something that affects every white person. And we can go ahead and be able to tell them that both Republicans and Democrats support this policy. Both of them are advocating for your own demise. We are the only ones who are standing and fighting for you. The other thing is about local control, of course. So the party motto is local solutions to the globalist problem. And that's something that the United States federal government has overreached all of its boundaries. And we believe in community choice. We believe in school choice, in having state choice to go ahead and return power to the people. And your average everyday white American feels like they have no power because essentially they don't. It's been stripped from them due to federal overreach going back now over 150 years to the war between the states. The federal government has been this way for a very long time. So a message of returning state sovereignty and power. This is not Constitution 10th Amendment stuff. This is about self-determination. And that's a message that was proven with Governor Wallace to be very successful among those that didn't have an issue, didn't really have feelings on segregation or things like that, or might have even thought that Governor Wallace was a little to the right of their liking. They understood that he was the only one who was standing up for their best interest to control how their children would be raised, to control what their communities were going to look like in 10 or 20 years. So I think that provides us a great framework. Now, political power. As we come to the last 5 minutes of the show, there's so much to talk about on this. I could do an entire series on it. But understanding political power, Governor Wallace knew he was not going to win 270 electoral votes. But he understood that he could force the electorate, of course, it went to the Electoral College, and there wasn't 270 votes, to then be able to go into the House of Representatives. His plan, of course, was to be able to have enough votes to force that, and then to be able to get concessions out of the system, as then the plan was to be building a larger grassroots network to be able to then win the next presidential election. And I think that's what provides us a huge amount of opportunity on the local and the state level to gain political power for white nationalist interests. Because if we can go ahead and start causing Republicans or Democratic incumbents that are especially egregious against us when it comes to supporting amnesty, more immigration, more free trade, more wars, if we run and get even a small percentage of the vote but continue to cost the incumbent politicians elections. I mean, you look at Paul Ryan now as he's throwing everything into being able to maintain the House majority, wants to maintain the Senate. If we could be able to change the direction of only one or two major races, that could allow us to have a huge amount of political power. Now, the average Republican, of course, I don't think is really ideologically aligned. They want political power. They like their nice, cushy jobs. They're weak-minded. Politicians is they really are weak people. And if we can be able to use our electoral strategy, as Wallace did, but do it on the local and the state level, perhaps even the federal level, to be able to be costing the system their incumbents, especially people like John McCain, for instance, or others, Paul Ryan in Wisconsin, to be able to get enough votes to cost them their elections. If we can be able to do that, then they have to be able to choose a position, continuing to lose, which they might do, or pivoting towards a more nationalist position. If they towards a more nationalist position, then we don't run another candidate. If they vote the right way, then we've essentially achieved victory. If we can get them, these incumbent politicians, using our political strength and our community organizing to be able to basically hold them politically hostage, doing that will essentially give us a victory. It'll basically, they won't be TWP candidates in office, but if they're voting the way we want them, because they know if they don't, they'll lose the next electoral cycle, that will punish them, and then we can use the average everyday white working class people, like Governor Wallace did, who might not agree with 100% of our message, just as a way to punish the political establishment, punish the incumbents, then we can be able to get massive concessions. That will then be based upon organizing to be able to take over communities, whether it's your school board, whether it's county commissioners, whether it's state legislative races that we can win outright. This is a strategy that works on several fronts of crafting a message for white America, from the East Coast to the West Coast, to be able to say that the system is waging a war against you, that they actively hate you. If you don't believe me, just look to the things that are coming out of the Republican elites, the Democratic elites. They're working against your interests. They're working against your children. And then organizing to be able to hold them politically hostage as we work to build power bases in specific regions. As we grow and are able to take over local areas, we can show the people that our form of governance of putting them first and their children first is better for them, is better for their children, is better for their community, it's better for everything from crime to their housing prices, to their schools. That is what they'll be able to understand, that it'll work on a multi-front process using the electoral system and community organizing as Europeans have done, such as Golden Dawn in Greece for Zanova. In Italy has done an amazing job of being able to advocate for their people there on the community level. We can learn a lot from that. So it's not just about votes, but it's using votes, it's using the electoral system along with our community organizing to come together and to be able to win the hearts and minds of our people, to show them that this is the path forward. And there is a tradition. If you look also in 92, Ross Perot, of course, was able to get a huge number of votes as a third party candidate. That changed the direction of the election. We can go ahead and craft this message that's a winning message for white men and women to be able to say that the system hates you. We're going to be able to push in this new direction and then build our power bases through different organizations here in the United States, working together to give community aid, to be able to build up our communities, invest in our communities, help our children, educate our children, and to be able to use this multi-pronged strategy to be able to bring things together. So as we come to the end of the show, it's something that we need to understand. We have huge potential. The only thing that is holding back our movement in the United States is us, is the psychology that we think that we're a fringe movement. We think that we're a small percentage. But if we can be able to educate, more mobilize, and organize white working class families, they can understand their true power, and their true power is that we can be able to take back our streets, take back our communities, take back our schools, and to be able to create a homeland for our people. So it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take using politics. It's going to take doing the great work we do here at Radio Aryan and other networks to be able to educate people. But we must craft a winning platform that will resonate with urbanites, with rural folks, that they understand that the only people fighting for white Americans is us, and to be able to then use our community outreach to mobilize us. Because when we realize our power, when we realize that we have the potential to stop this, the thing that will stop this failed multicultural experiment, that will stop the bleeding of our finances and our blood on these globalist projects, is simply standing up and saying no more. We will not do this anymore. We have the numbers, we have the power, and we have the heart and the talent to be able to achieve the final victory that we need. So comrades, understand that we have the power. We simply need this blueprint. We need to work together. We must struggle together, fight together, and then we will win together. So keep the faith, regardless of what happens in November. We are marching forward to victory, and we can do this to be able to achieve a future for our children, our culture, and our blood. So thank you guys so much for being here. I'm going to be here with one of my regular co-hosts tomorrow. And just remember, we have the power. We just need to start understanding how powerful we really are. Thank you guys so much, and as always, hail victory!
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioAryan.com.